David Lazarus, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of June 13th, 2014. This week, love and marriage. We all know how the song goes, but what happens when you and your sweetie aren't on the same financial page? We'll also be talking strategies for winning your World Cup office pool. But first, the epic video game conference known as E3 just wrapped up in LA this week. I might not be the most formidable gamer in history, but I do have a 12-year-old boy at home, and he's playing Call of Duty even as we speak. So I know a thing or two about games. And so does my guest, I'm glad to say. Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech. He's here to fill us in on all things gaming. Hiya, Ben. How you doing?
Hi, David. How are you?
Good. So I'm here not just representing myself, but 12-year-old boys everywhere.
As am I, always.
Exactly. And E3 has been going on, and this is like the mecca of video games. What's going on out there?
Well, it's pretty interesting. We're seeing a lot of different tacks for the mainstream console makers, at the very least. There was a lot of expectation, for instance, that Xbox, Microsoft's console, was going to come out with a new Halo game. Of course, Halo has sold millions of copies around the world. It's this, you know, you're fighting aliens and it's kind of a shoot 'em up game.
In fact, I'd prefer if you'd call me Master Chief for the rest of this.
Done and done. But it's spawned and respawned many times, so to speak. But actually what the company did was release this kind of almost like a Criterion Collection 1080p super remastered collector's edition of the first four games. But also what Xbox did, which is kind of interesting, is it's going to produce these original Halo television shows, one of which is going to come out this year, produced by Ridley Scott. And then next year, another TV show will come out from Steven Spielberg. And this is really interesting. It's this kind of like play to sort of be like, okay, this is an incredibly popular title. Maybe we can get people into the game and into the franchise by producing television and see maybe if we can get some new gamers that way, which I thought was interesting.
Can you say synergy, boys and girls?
And so that's, you know, another kind of interesting play. But then PlayStation, you know, announced that it's doing this kind of move, in the U.S. at least, to offer people more access to gaming in the cloud. It announced PlayStation TV is going to be available for people in the U.S. and it lets users stream and play games, you know, in their living room and sort of collect things all in one place.
To all these guys, they want to be the box maker. They want to be the entree to your home entertainment system.
Absolutely. I think, you know, it's an interesting kind of changing marketplace. Obviously, mobile has made a huge has really changed basically the video game industry. There's a lot of things happening in that space, but a lot of the big console makers are basically trying to figure out ways to kind of branch out and offer these things that might, you know, gain some mainstream appeal in other ways and also kind of take over your living room. Absolutely.
Are we seeing new technologies coming to the fore? For example, 3D. For years now, people have been saying 3D was going to be the next big thing for gaming. Not quite yet. It's not.
No, it's not quite yet. But what I like to comically refer to face-based technology, some of these, virtual reality headsets that are starting to pop up. Oculus Rift obviously was there. Oculus VR was obviously there. Project Morpheus, which is Sony's kind of face-based, we'll call it, technology that they're slowly rolling out. What's interesting is it seems like both of those examples, at the very least, are not far enough along yet, or now that Oculus was recently bought by Facebook, they're just not at this place where they're going to, you know, put it out on the market and you can go out and get your virtual reality headset and you know, live forever in a virtual world as a regular consumer. But what they are doing is demoing just at all of these things. They're everywhere. And, you know, that's no less true at E3. And I think what they're trying to do is basically give people an introduction to this idea, because it's pretty weird, right? Putting this thing on your face and then being able to see 360-degree gaming environments and really drum up a lot of buzz about virtual reality. And then eventually, you know, they'll really introduce it to the market.
I'm telling you, it's just a matter of time before we're jacking into the Matrix. I mean, this face-based thing, it's transitional. You're going to sit in your chair and the thing in the back of the head and you are in business.
I know. And it's scary. And it's interesting, too. I mean, Facebook, obviously, the purchase of Oculus is really interesting. But just, you know, a reminder to folks out there, Sony's Project Morpheus, not necessarily in a bad way. I mean, Sony has sold a ton of PlayStation 4s this year. They've been kicking Xbox One's butt sales-wise, and they finally overtook Nintendo's sales, at least in terms of consoles. So you might see Sony make a big play next in the face-based space.
Ben Johnson is a Tetris master and the host of Marketplace Tech. Ben, thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Money problems are one of the leading causes of relationship strife. It's like the saying goes, love is grand and divorce is 100 grand. So we're looking into what you should know before you walk down the aisle. To help us with that, we're joined by relationship expert Andrea Sirtash, author of Cheat on Your Husband with Your Husband. Thanks for being here, Andrea.
Thanks. Good to be back.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about this. First of all, the biggest question is, how important is this conversation?
It's extremely important. I can't stress that enough. In fact, we know that money is one of the things that drive couples apart if they're not aligned. The most awkward issues to discuss, like sex and money, are the very things you need to put on the table before you walk down the aisle.
I saw a story the other day that said not just that that's correct and you need to have that conversation, but you need to lay it all out there, such as your FICO score and all that. I can't imagine any circumstance where you're going to say, baby, let me tell you about my FICO score.
Yeah, probably not that way anyway. It's not the most romantic conversation you're going to have. But, you know, it is a very important one to lay on the table. The best time to do it is when you're getting along. You know, when you're in the romantic stage and everything about your partner seems great is the very time when you should broach it, because you'll probably be more open to listening to each other. And, you know, your perspectives, your plans, your values, all of that needs to be addressed.
So how voluminous is this conversation? It's one thing to say, yeah, I want kids, or yeah, I want a house, or yeah, I want this kind of car. But do you also want to get into the real details of this kind of thing? Like, here's my credit score, here's how much debt I'm carrying, and, you know, that level of minutia.
Put everything on the table, because so much of effective relationships are about managing expectations. And you need to go in with your eyes wide open. And that doesn't just mean learning about your partner's history, your partner's finances. And it's also about exposing your own vulnerabilities around this. You'll feel better entering a partnership with that kind of level of honesty and openness.
What happens if your partner lays it all out there and you suddenly realize, boy, we really don't look at money the same way?
Today, people marry much later. Oftentimes, they've lived as adults outside of their parents' home for a number of years before they tie the knot with someone else. So you're going to have different perspectives on a number of things. And, you know, that's what partnership is about. You come in with different perspectives and you find common ground. And where you don't find common ground, the hope is that you'll have ultimately the same core values.
But what if you don't have that? What if everything else is great? You like the same movies, you like the same sports team, you love being together, and then you discover that he or she has a mountain of debt, is a compulsive online shopper, has a lousy credit score, and all of those red flags that says, here's somebody who can't manage money.
Well, that might be a red flag that ultimately breaks you apart. I mean, I'm not going to lie. That could easily be a deal breaker. The question you have to ask if you're marrying someone who's coming in with tremendous debt is, what is your plan? What does the future look like? What have you started to do to, you know, get clear on this debt? And if the person is just accumulating more debt and has a crazy spending problem, how are you dealing with that? And do you recognize that that may be an issue? You see, you don't need to come into a relationship with both people being fully evolved and perfect. In fact, that's kind of boring, but there needs to be a plan in place. If you don't trust him on some deep level or her on some deep level, it is never going to work. Money aside.
You just mentioned merging of finances. I often advise new couples, or at least new marrieds, to indeed do that, to pool all the money, because this is going to be a big expression of trust in each other. Where do you come down on that?
My role in a relationship is what's normal is what's normal to the couple. So it's really about negotiating what both parties feel comfortable with. I can't say there's one right way because I've interviewed people on either side who say, well, this works for us. But you need to be aligned and you need to be open. You cannot have one side saying this is a priority, this is a value, and the other side resenting that. That'll never work.
One other thing that comes to mind, and that is the whole idea of a prenup. I'm here in L.A., and so the prenup is kind of a fact of life for a lot of people. But I wonder where you come down on this, because it's hard to imagine anything more clinical, more chilly than the idea of saying, all right, let's legally carve up what's mine is mine and what's yours is yours.
Well, you know, I don't think wanting a prenup means that you love your money more than your marriage, but that's how many people will interpret it, you know? So again, it's about negotiating and communicating. You know, it may be something that one side feels very strongly about, and it's essential for the person who feels the strongest about it to clearly communicate and convey why it's important. For many people, if you earn wildly different salaries, if you come from a broken home and, you know, marriage feels a little bit overwhelming, they feel more secure having this practical, what they see as a very practical approach should, God forbid, things not work out. For someone else, that may feel like a betrayal.
Is a prenup for everyone, or is it just for Kim and Kanye?
it's not for everyone. It's absolutely not forever. It's not just for Hollywood celebrities. There are many people who have prenups who you wouldn't even think, well, what are you really protecting here? But no, it's not for everyone. One size does not fit all when it comes to anything in a relationship.
We're going to get into your questions in just a moment. And as everybody knows, that's my favorite part of the show. I'm looking at some of the questions out there, and they seem to have some love-related themes to them. And this is right up your alley. Andrea, can you stick around?
Absolutely.
Next on the show, we're keeping the romance alive. How to keep a huge debt from tanking your relationship. Later on, looking for a job when you already have one is a risky business, because guess who else is lurking on Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn? That'd be your boss.
Employers are still quite vindictive, punitive. They will fire people sometimes if they find out they're looking, sometimes summarily, right on the spot.
How to stay incognito during an online job hunt. That's coming up on Marketplace Money from APM. And now I'm glad to say it's my favorite part of the show, which is your part of the show when we talk about your money issues. And we were just talking before the break about love and money, marriage and money. And since we got a few questions up that particular alley, let's keep that theme going. And thus, our guest remains with us, and that would be Andrea Sirtash, who is the author of a number of books about dating and marriage, including Cheat on Your Husband with Your Husband. Andrea, thank you for being here.
Happy to be here.
All right. So you and I were going back and forth on the do's and don'ts of setting up a marriage, financially speaking. Now let's talk about some real life situations. We're going to get into a call in just a sec, but first I want to look at an email here. This one's from Chad in Porter's Corner, New York, and it's an interesting situation. Basically, he's saying that he has great credit, no debt, no school loans. He owns his own business. His wife, on the other hand, is carrying about $50,000 in credit card debt. He says that she's an overspender. He says she doesn't keep track of it. She's got horrible credit, has a very hard time maintaining her income levels, her tax levels. I mean, it's just the whole thing. And he's wondering, what do you do about something like that? Should he step up, give her the money to resolve her issues? Should he give her a little bit of tough love? It's a real thorny issue. And you and I were talking about prenups before, so this is sort of a prenup type question for people who aren't Kim and Kanye and might not have the prenup. And let me put it to you first. When you have that wide a financial disparity, but you've already got the relationship going, you are already married, how big a problem is that?
It's a very big problem, because Chad clearly already has resentment. The issue is he should not enable it. So to answer that simply, the answer is no. Don't give her more money. Do not enable this bad habit. You know, this is a deeper issue than money and spending versus saving, because I'm sure on a number of levels, Chad is withholding his feelings and his needs. If he were on the phone, I would ask him that. How is this manifesting in other areas of your relationship? What has he not told his wife that she needs to hear? And that might be the tough love you're talking about. It doesn't need to come off with judgment and criticism. It can come off in a very, he can position it in a very loving way to say, you know, how can we together get to a better place with this? Because they're partners after all. Chad's not the passenger and she's not the driver. I interview so many couples in this situation where one person is being very passive, not always about money. It could be about sex. It could be about so many things. One person is passive. The other person is driving. You need two drivers to make a relationship move forward. So Chad does need to step up. Rather than resenting his wife, he does need to open the conversation. I'm sure there are things he's telling us that he hasn't told her that have just, again, manifested in weird ways. So it's time for him to really put this on the table with her and not hold back.
Chad, I'm completely with Andrea on this, but the thing I want to emphasize is this is a conversation that's all about tone, because anytime you bring up money or sex for that matter, it can come off in a threatening fashion, and the conversation, yeah, and the conversation gets derailed before you even get to where you're going, and that's not how you want to do it. So the way to approach something like this, let's keep it narrowly focused on money, is to talk about how her situation has made you uncomfortable and how that's a problem that you want to deal with. So it's not her problem anymore. Now it's your problem, but she can be a partner in resolving that. And now you're on a good footing because she's going to try and help you deal with your issue as opposed to you being Mr. Fix-It, which I know is a natural role for all guys, as opposed to you doing that and stepping up and trying to fix her. And let's face it, there isn't a woman around who wants to be fixed by a guy. So that's not going to happen. That's off the table. So laying it all out, especially in the way that Andrea just talked about and talking about how a lot of these things are issues for the two of you because you're partners, if you can approach it in a way that makes her feel that she is a part of the team in finding a solution, my sense is she's going to want to participate in it. And then at some point, you're going to need to probably lower the boom and maybe get her some plastic that has a lower credit limit. Just think about it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Absolutely. I would add, and I love that you said that, David, because fighting fairly is such an important part of health and happiness in a relationship. So as long as you don't attack her character, it will be a conversation and not something she'll recoil and be defensive and uncomfortable around.
Andrea, we got to take a break. Can you stick around and help me answer some listener questions?
Absolutely.
Back with relationship expert Andrea Sirtash. Let's get into a call. This is Amy calling from Washington, D.C. Hi, Amy.
Hi, David.
How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me on.
What's new in Washington, D.C.? Are you to blame for all the gridlock there?
No, I don't think you can blame that on me.
What do I want to blame on you? What's going on in your life?
Well, it's starting to get really hot and humid here in D.C., and all anyone is talking about is the fact that Eric Cantor lost his primary.
That was a very big deal.
Yeah.
All right. So let's get away from politics, which isn't really our purview here, and talk about money. What's your money situation?
So my question that I wrote in about is actually about what my boyfriend should do with his money. But the context of the situation involves me because we're planning on getting engaged in the near future, and we want to do whatever we can to be financially prepared for the costs that come along with that.
Well, how are you two apart?
What do you mean?
Well, what I mean by that is, how is it that you two aren't on the same page? What is it that keeps you apart financially?
You mean in terms of combining our finances, or...
Is the question here whether you guys should be pooling all your money and getting it all together, or are you looking at Mr. Groom-to-be and thinking, I've got some questions about where he's at? What is it that, I mean, in a nutshell, what is it that's prompting you to ask me for advice?
Okay, so basically, I mean, luckily, my boyfriend is pretty financially responsible. He's, you know, checking all the boxes in terms of, you know, putting away money for retirement and having an emergency fund built up. And basically, he has about $400 to $600 that he's consistently putting away every month into just a regular savings account. So he has a good bit of money in his savings account beyond what he needs for an emergency fund. And I'm just wondering if there isn't anything better that he could be doing with that money, but keeping in mind that we might need some of that money on hand in the next couple of years for the expenses that come along with, you know, engagement and marriage.
You're talking about his money. Are you not saving?
I'm sorry?
What about you? Are you saving?
I am saving.
So you're both saving.
I actually
saving.
Just got a new job, so I don't have my emergency fund built up, so that's the thing that I'm working on.
What does your fiancé want to do with his money?
Well, that's the question that he had, and he was, you know, asking around to some of his friends about what he should do with it. So I decided to ask in to a professional about what he should do with that money, because that was a question that he had, and I didn't feel comfortable with him just taking advice from, you know, a friend that he asked.
And just to be clear, it sounds like he's a responsible guy, so he's not saying, you know, honey, I think I should put this money aside for trips to Vegas and strip clubs.
No, not at all. He's very responsible. I mean, he's only 26, and he already has, you know, $30,000 put away for retirement.
All right. And would the game plan be then that he and you will take your respective savings and put them together, or are you two going to save independently?
Well, right now we're saving independently, but obviously, you know, if moving forward, we would want to merge those things.
All right. I've got some advice for you. But first, let's bring back Andrea Sirtash. All right. You've heard the contours of this relationship and this key sensitive spot of where the two of them are at. How do they get past this into where they need to be next?
Well, the good news is that Amy and her partner are communicating. So that let's just acknowledge that for a moment. It's on the table. That's a great thing. You don't need to have the answer right away. What you need to figure out, you know, what often attracts you in a relationship repels you as well. So you may be so attracted to your partner because he is a little more conservative. He is responsible. He is stable. And maybe that's the very thing that makes you, that makes you question certain habits in terms of his spending and his saving. Have you, I don't know if that resonates, but it's very common in a spender-saver dynamic to have, you know, there's a risk-taking element on one side and then a stable, nurturing partner on the other, and they can work well together. They just need to communicate. So do you have, Amy, an ideal? Is it that you would rather spend some of the money now that he's saving for later? Is that part of what's on the table here?
Not necessarily. I felt like there might be a smarter way for him to be utilizing that money instead of just putting it into a regular savings account where it's not really doing anything.
Well, let's look at some of the specifics that you're facing. First of all, you're not engaged yet, right? You're thinking about engagement.
Right.
Are you expecting him to splurge on a nice rock for your finger?
No, absolutely not. I actually object to engagement rings.
Excuse me? What?
Yeah. Well, I just have some feminist objections to this symbolism, and I just don't think it's a really good practical decision for, you know, a couple in the early stages of a relationship to be spending that much money on something that is more or less frivolous.
I admire your financial acumen here, but I don't know if I would look at an engagement ring as a handcuff. I'm just saying, it's a wonderful representation of not just what your plans are, but the commitment that you're making.
That's fair. I think, it's just not my cup of tea, I guess.
Okay, well, and that's totally your thing. What about kids? You guys going to have kids?
I don't want kids, but probably we would both want a house eventually.
So,
well, sorry, David, go on.
Well, all right, so it sounds like your financial horizon now is already being defined. If you're not going to have kids, that's an entire avenue of financial planning that you're now going to shut down and allow yourselves to make other plans. But I do want to say this. You never know when the unexpected may happen. And so
that's fair too.
When you shut things down, it's always good to have a backup plan, if you will, because I'm just saying, things happen in a relationship, as in money. And, you know, we'll talk for a little bit about what you could be looking at now, but just keep that in mind. Andrea, what were you going to say?
Oh, exactly. I was going to say, you know, your needs or his needs at 26 may look very different in 5, 10, 15 years. My basic relationship rule is to never say always and or never and always are not good words when it comes to a relationship, because you will change and some of your needs may change. That's why you need to keep communicating through these things. That's ultimately what I was going to say.
I never say always. Wait a minute.
But you never say never, and you always say always.
I say something like that. So anyway, Amy, if you're not looking at kids on the short term, you are probably looking at a house, yeah?
Yes.
All right. So that's your first big financial target, and I think the smart play here, because, like I was saying before, I think it is a nice expression of trust when a couple, especially a married couple, starts putting their finances together and making those big decisions. So if you're looking at having 20% down, let's say, for a piece of property, then this is a good time to start putting that target together, putting a time frame together. And then I'll tell you right now from experience, it's fun once you guys start shopping together and start seeing how your tastes are either totally on the same page or totally not on the same page. And gradually you start finding those places that appeal to you in the same way that when you walk through a house and you open doors and look what's behind them, you're going to do the exact same thing with your relationship through that process. It's really interesting how that works.
Mm-hmm. So is the best way to start building up, you know, to start saving money for a down payment, is the best way to do that in just a regular savings account? Or is there something else that he could be doing with that money?
And that brings up the next thing, and that is your respective appetites for risk. And this is going to define how comfortable you are with your investments. Investments are all about how well you can sleep at night. That's the whole thing. I mean, there are bad investments and good investments, I guess, but everybody will look at them differently. So it's all about you and how well you'll sleep at night. So if having too much risk is going to keep you from getting any Z's, then you need to lower that threshold. In other words, a low-risk investment would be, say, an index fund or money market or something like that that doesn't have a lot of exposure to the to-ing and fro-ing of the financial world. If, on the other hand, you want to roll the dice a little bit more, expose yourself to more potential upside, but also more potential downside, want to underline that, then you ratchet up the risk a little bit with something that might be a little more aggressive, like, say, a tech fund or something along those lines. And again, that's a conversation you want to have together. And I think the best way to couch that is in the way that I just did. Don't talk about, ooh, I want to put money in Google or I want to put money in Johnson & Johnson, but rather, how much risk do I want? How much risk can I be comfortable with on a day-to-day basis? And I'll bet you that the two of you will very quickly find that you're on the same page with that kind of thing. Andrea?
I definitely agree, but it's about opening up the communication. Exactly.
So, Amy, I think it's just crucial that you define where those limits are going to be, and that's what's going to guide these questions. So in terms of where he puts his money, and I'm thinking where you put your money as well, think about the property, because that's going to be your next big investment in life. Think about where you want to park your money relative to how much risk you want to take on. And when you're young, you can take on a lot more risk than when you become a little more advanced in life. So something to keep in mind as well. And as we're always saying on this show, you might want to consult a financial professional when you start making decisions. And even all the discount brokerages out there, Schwab, Fidelity, all those guys, they got people on staff who will sit down with you and help you put together a portfolio that represents your needs. So you're not traveling here just two people in the dark with a flashlight. You can actually get help.
Okay, that sounds good.
All right, and here's the big takeaway I want to give for you. Do it all together.
Got it.
Yeah?
Yes.
All right, and here's the next thing I want you to do. After you have your talk with the soon-to-be Mr. Amy, email us back, tell us what you did, and how it all worked out, okay?
Okay.
All right, Amy, thank you so much for calling.
Great, thanks so much.
Andrea, as we walked through all of this stuff, the email, the call, did you get a sense of anything being different, or is this par for the course?
It's par for the course. I mean, the good news is these people have been thoughtful enough to ask the question and to explore some answers. So that's good news, rather than letting things, you know, manifest in other weird ways. She may not know. A lot of times people just feel uncomfortable with how their partner is treating money in this instance, but not even have the answer of what she needs. She just needs to explore what feels more comfortable. And that may take some trial and error. And that's where your partners, you can meet in the middle and find out together where you're just a little more comfortable.
Andrea Sirtash is the author of a number of books on dating and marriage, including Cheat on Your Husband with Your Husband. Andrea, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was fun.
You've got money questions? You know you do. Well, we got money answers, and we want to share the wealth. So get in touch, why don't you? You can email us at marketplacemoney.org. You can tweet us at LiveMoney, or you can even record a question, because that's the kind of highbrow operation we're running here. Go to marketplacemoney.org, click on the little blue button that says record audio, and, well, record audio. Can't wait to hear from you. Your World Cup bracket may be complete, but is it on the money?
Everybody in your pool is going to have Brazil, so it could come down to, you know, the person who picked Colombia to get out of Group C as opposed to Ivory Coast, or, you know, the prescient prognosticator who had Uruguay making it to the semifinals. So you've got to pay close attention to those early round picks.
We'll look at the odds of that elusive perfect pick. That's coming up on Marketplace Money from APM. Is the season for another crop of young people to get out of academia and into the workforce. There will be a new set of do's and don'ts for these young folks to learn, but are these do's and don'ts any different than they ever were? Here to talk about work in the age of social media is Fox Business contributor Andrea Murad. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, David.
Before we get into some of the details of this, is this a thing? The young people today in the age of Facebook and Twitter and sharing and sharing and sharing, is it a thing that they don't know how to behave in the workplace?
I don't know if it's a thing that everybody doesn't know how to behave in the workplace, but I do think no matter what the generation is, it's a little bit of a shock to go from college to working full time.
And so they get into these workplaces where there are clear hierarchies and clear ways of acquitting yourself. And some of these folks who might really come from a background where it's okay to share everything might not get it. Is that kind of the thrust of this?
That's one of the thrusts of the whole working full time from college. I also think that there's just a big change in your daily schedule. In college, you pay to attend. You can go to classes if you want to, or if you don't, because they don't take attendance. You get constant feedback, and you kind of get out of it what you put into it. But at a job, they pay you to be there. You have to be there. And if you're not, you could very well lose that job.
All right. Well, let's run through some of your advice in the piece that you wrote. Number one, ask questions and observe.
Yes. I think it's really important to understand how the workplace environment works. How do people communicate with each other? How do they set up meetings? What do they do in meetings? Do they take notes? Do they bring their laptops? And just understand the general office culture. I think that's really important, because knowing the culture and being able to fit in goes a long way in your career.
All right. Number two, show up on time and be present. And that sounds really important.
I believe Woody Allen said that most of, like, 90% of life is just showing up. Same thing with your job. Be there on time, the same time everybody else is there. Work the same hours. Don't come in late. Don't make excuses for being late. Don't leave early. And be present. So that means when people are talking to you, look at them. Don't check emails. Don't check Facebook. Don't tweet. And just pay attention and be engaged in the conversation.
So is my voluminous past in social media a plus, or a negative in an environment like this? Because everybody now is expected to be engaged in social media. But once you're working for a company, you have a different set of criteria because it's not all about me, me, me anymore.
No, it's not. And I think social media, that's a whole other issue because you need to be very careful what you put on social media, the pictures from college, the types of pictures that are on social media, what your friends post. I think it's best that you limit the social media presence that you have. And if you do have a presence, try and shape that presence so that it really is geared more towards your professional life.
One of your tips here, go above and beyond. Again, for a generation that's grown up feeling a certain sense of entitlement, that might be an alien thought.
Yes, managing up is a very difficult concept, but it's something that we do throughout our entire career. And really what the goal of managing up is, so that it basically the person takes on more responsibilities of their manager. So if their manager asks them for two solutions, maybe they'll come up with three. They always come up with another option and they do a little bit more extra research. And then eventually they start on taking on more responsibility and lighten the plate of their manager so that their manager can do other things. And eventually it leaves room for that person to grow into their manager's role. It's a great skill and it's a great attribute to have that will only help you get promoted throughout your career.
I remember interviewing a Hollywood director once who told me about a production assistant, a PA that he had, who did her job well, but never did any more than she had to. And this director really noticed it. He constantly had to be coming back to her with another assignment, with another request, because she simply never took the initiative.
That's taking the initiative is huge. And I'm sure that the production assistant never really moved up the ranks, didn't matter how talented she was. But I think the more that you do and the more that you're willing to take on, that's only going to help your cause. If your manager is there all hours of the night and you're not there asking them, what can I do to help? Can I take on some of this? Or even if you just do it on your own and then show your manager that they've done all of this work to kind of lighten your manager's load, it's only going to make you shine.
So let's say I've just finished the project that I was working on. Should I kick back now and start goofing around on Facebook and Twitter?
No. And in fact, in the office, being on Facebook and Twitter, unless it's a part of your job responsibility, is really not a good way to spend your time. And if you have time to be on Facebook and Twitter, that's when it's important to find something to do. So ask your manager for more work to do. Even ask your coworkers if they need help on some of their projects. Or if there's nothing to do, read up on your industry and take that time to learn.
Good God, you make it sound like college never ends.
It never ends. Learning is a lifetime pursuit.
All right, I'm going to tweet that right now. Andrea Murad is a Fox Business contributor. Andrea, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So now that you have that first gig, what do you do when you're ready to move on? How do you network for new jobs while keeping your old one? Here's one tip. Don't blab on LinkedIn that you're on the market. And for more, let's check in with Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman. Hiya, Mitchell. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, David. It's good to be here.
All right. So talk to me a little bit about how I want to be playing a career in the age of all that social media.
Well, you know, it's challenging because in some ways, this is the moment in which it has never been easier to look for a job, especially while you have a job, right? Because you can spend time in LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter. You're actually supposed to be doing that. Your boss wants you to be doing that because you're supposed to post interesting articles and make comments on blog posts and in forums and things like that, all of which sort of promote your company and your brand. The problem is that it's also pretty transparent. You have to be pretty careful. You know, you post something that says, gee, I'm interested in opportunities, ... And if your boss or someone who knows your boss sees that, that could very easily get back to them. So you have a sort of confidentiality dilemma there. You need to be out there. And if you're out there, you might look like you're too out there.
But are there people who actually do that? I mean, like everyone else, I try to be active in social media because I'm supposed to be. But the idea of saying, I'm open to other opportunities, ... knowing full well that all of my bosses are reading what I'm doing. Note to bosses, by the way, I love my job. Who would do that?
Well, if you don't do that, how do you get noticed, right? So you need to be making sure that people who might think of you for a job actually think of you for a job and don't just assume that, you know, you're very happy where you are and you're just doing your duty as a networker. The challenge is to do it in a way that is careful enough until you get to the point at which you're actually applying for a job.
It seems like the age of vocational monogamy is behind us. There are no more men in gray flannel suits anymore. Do bosses at most companies kind of have an understanding now that the younger workforce are job hoppers by nature?
You know, you'd think they would. And of course, in some senses, yes, because they're busy recruiting and poaching other people from other companies. They're the ones doing the searches on LinkedIn looking for candidates. On the other hand, there's a sort of difference between, you know, are they surprised? No. Are they, you know, pissed and irritated if it actually happens? Yes. Clearly they are. You know, they want to keep people until they're ready to let them go, right? They don't want to keep them forever. They're keeping them less long than, you know, ever before. But there is still sort of this attitude of that they're the ones with the upper hand, I guess is how you'd say it. I talked about this with Jean Erickson Walker. She's an executive coach, and she coaches people about sort of just this transition of when to try to finally start looking for new work. And what she's found actually is that employers are still quite vindictive, punitive. They will fire people sometimes if they find out they're looking, sometimes summarily right on the spot.
I've had at least two people in the last 6 months who were fired immediately. So it's very dangerous. I think you have to be very subtle about it. And I tell my clients, always, always have a written, not a verbal offer before you quit the job you have.
All right, so let's say I find a job via social media or even the old school ways of doing it. Are there any rules of quitting?
Yeah, no matter what this last job was like. And look, a lot of people have been stuck in jobs for years now that they were afraid to leave, even though they weren't so great for them, and are just now starting to feel like there's this, you know, opening. You do it politely. You don't burn bridges. Most important, you want to make sure that job that you're leaving, you know, will be the reference next time because jobs aren't that secure anymore. And David, here's something I've always wondered about personally. Okay, so you've got this new job, right? And you're about to walk out the door. Now, maybe the job's been great. You know, it's just like a family. It's totally well run. But I don't know. In my experience, it's more like, you know, everyone's backbiters. Departments are siloed off against each other. The place is totally dysfunctional. And then your boss wants to do this exit interview. You know, you're supposed to be honest. They say, we want to make things better for the next promising young thing so they don't leave. So I asked Peter Post what you're supposed to do about this. He's at the Emily Post Institute. He's actually one of the great grandchildren of Emily Post. And he co-authored a book called The Etiquette Advantage in Business.
I'd be careful about, you know, laying out all of the things that you see as problems with the business that you're leaving just as you're walking out the door. You may end up stepping on a toe. 5 years from now, all of a sudden that person that you've been trashing is a person who's in a position that you need something from.
You know, so the bottom line, you know, you don't flamethrow. You don't shout, you can't fire me because I quit and walk out the door. You know, you politely take your leave, no matter how awful it was, and you hope you can ask for a reference next time around.
Mitchell Hartman is senior reporter for Marketplace's Entrepreneurship Desk. Mitchell, nice working with you.
Thanks, David.
Remember back when Warren Buffett was offering $1 billion to whoever could come up with a perfect March Madness bracket? Of course, no one did, and Buffett walked away the winner. So now the World Cup is here, and once again, you may have spent hours crafting the perfect bracket. What are your odds of a clean sweep? To talk about that, we're joined by Josh Levine, executive editor of Slate and host of the sports podcast Hang Up and Listen. Welcome, Josh.
Hey, are you going to announce the Marketplace Money Billion Dollar Challenge?
I'm prepared to put up all the money that Marketplace is prepared to give me. And thus, we will be having the Marketplace Chick-fil-A Coupon Challenge. And I'm very excited about it. But that said, is there a way to actually finesse the brackets for the World Cup?
The bracket for the World Cup is way more challenging than the March Madness bracket in one sense. And that's that the bracket transmogrifies based on who wins in the group stage. So in the NCAA tournament, you know that if Duke wins in the first round, then they're going to play a certain team in the second round. But in the World Cup, if Brazil finishes first in its group, then it's on the left side of the bracket. If they finish second in the group, then they're on the right side of the bracket. So you kind of need to predict how teams are going to do in space and in time. So there's an additional challenge there. There are fewer teams, though, and there is, I think, more of a separation of the top dogs from the minnows in soccer than there is in the NCAA tournament.
So this is like trying to beat Khan in a space battle. You have to think in three dimensions.
Something like that, yes.
Star Trek reference, everybody. Keep up now. All right, so let's pretend for a moment that I'm not a huge soccer guy or football guy. Is the World Cup a difficult thing to get your hands around in terms of which team is going to be the winner?
Everybody thinks that Brazil is going to win. It's just, do you think Brazil is really, really, really going to win, or you think they're just probably going to win? Nate Silver of 538.com fame, using his soccer power index that he developed for ESPN, he says Brazil has a 45% chance to win the tournament, which is just huge, kind of overwhelming.
Wait a minute. How do you deduce that? Is there actually an algorithm for this?
There is an algorithm based on past performance. He looks at how teams have done in the World Cup on home soil. It considers the fact that Brazil has not lost a competitive game at home since 1975, which is something you'd probably want to factor in. If they haven't been beaten in 40 years, that's something that you should consider. And also, Brazil's just got a really, really, really strong team. And so it all kind of factors in, and that's what this formula spits out.
How many people gamble on the World Cup?
I've read, and you can take this with a grain of salt, that Interpol speculates that there are in the upper hundreds of billions of dollars bet on international soccer on a yearly basis. And on the World Cup, you can imagine that it's certainly in the billions as well.
So there's obviously the office pool that a lot of people might be doing. Is this something you can also take to Vegas?
You can, yeah. There are odds in all of the Vegas casinos about who's going to win. And you can also place bets on the British betting markets. You're not allowed to do that if you're an American, but any intrepid people from the UK who are listening to this, that's another option. And then you can, yeah, as you said, put some money on the coffee can at the water cooler in the office.
Now, other than this fine program and your fine podcast, where's a good place to get inside dope on how the various teams are doing for the World Cup?
Well, all of the games are broadcast on ESPN across their platform of 4,000 different networks. And they've also got an excellent podcast themselves, Men in Blazers, and they've been doing previews of all the teams, all the groups. But, you know, there's a multitude, depending on whether you want extremely biased information supporting the home team or whether you want a more straight look at who's really looking good and who's looking weak.
I guess I just want to know whether the Brazilian team has come down with dysentery or not.
As of this afternoon, they are looking good with in the dysentery index.
And have you put down anything on a bracket for this?
I'm going to go not contrarian and go with the Brazilians. It seems extremely unlikely that they're not going to come out on top. Spain is the defending champ. They've won three major tournaments in a row, but they're looking a little ragged, like the legs are starting to go a bit. So I like the Brazilians to take out the Spaniards in the final.
So with all this in mind, what are the odds of anyone actually prevailing and winning an office pool here? I mean, if everybody goes with Brazil, that's kind of that. Or you never know who's going to actually come away with this thing.
Well, if Brazil does win, then your picks in the earlier rounds are going to be key because everybody in your pool is going to have Brazil. So it could come down to, you know, the person who picked Colombia to get out of Group C as opposed to Ivory Coast or, you know, the prescient prognosticator who had Uruguay making it to the semifinals. So you've got to pay close attention to those early round picks. But if you want kind of a sleeper, if you want an underdog team that's not the Brazilians, but, you know, could stand a chance, look to the South American teams. South American teams always do well in South America. You've got Chile, Colombia, Uruguay. They're all going to do well. I think probably do a little better than you might think. And probably don't pick Italy. I'm not feeling Italy this year.
Take that, Italy. Josh Levine is the executive editor of Slate, and he is the host of their very cool sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen. Josh, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, David.
Well, that's Marketplace Money for this week. I'll be back again next week for what will be the last installment of this Radio Money Palooza. But don't fret. Lizzie O'Leary returns at the end of the month with a brand new show, Marketplace Weekend. We'll have her on to chat about that. For now, let's roll credits. Marketplace Money is produced by Candace Manricus and Caitlin Fenaro. Our senior producer is Dan Simatovich. Chris Clark is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. Remember, as always, to check with your financial professional before you make any big money decisions. I'm David Lazarus, and until next time, I'll see you in the business section. This is APM.